Office Messes by Elisa Belkin. When Vivian Sales finally broke her silence, she did so loudly, losing her temper in the hush library where she worked. It was August 2003, and she had been hanging on to her job as a reference librarian by the most fragile of threads. For more than a year, her supervisors at the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, Arizona, had been warning her that she was sometimes sloppy and inaccurate. She was late for work too often, they said. She didn't dress neatly and appropriately. Her desk was always a mess. Sales knew all this. She also knew why. 3 years earlier, when she was 36, she was told she had attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. That's the full name of the condition, and while its initials are technically ADHD, not all who have it exhibit the hyperactivity symptoms, so it is often referred to conversationally as simply ADD. The news was a relief because it seemed to explain everything, why she rarely seemed to fit into a workplace, why she left 9 different jobs in 1999 alone, why, despite 2 master's degrees and years of dogged hard work, she never seemed to get anywhere. Although the diagnosis was illuminating, Sales was determined to keep her condition to herself. Work isn't like school, where they have to give you more time on the tests if you have ADD, she explained. In the real world, if you tell during the interview, they won't hire you. And if you tell after you're hired, they can't fire you. That's not a precise reading of the law, but it is an accurate reading of the stigma and of the dilemma that will probably become more common in the coming years. First, there was ADD in children, and the debate over whether too many are being medicated for what is arguably normal behavior. Now that conversation has widened to include adults. Psychiatrists used to assure parents that ADD was something their children would outgrow, but more recent research shows that the disorder is longer lasting than originally thought. ADD does not develop in adulthood, but neither does it always disappear after childhood. Instead, up to 60% of children with ADD grow up to be adults who still have ADD, and experts estimate that more than 8 million grown-ups in the United States have the disorder. These numbers, presented by researchers from Harvard and the World Health Organization at the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association this spring, mean that attention deficit disorder affects 4.4% of the adult population, making it the second most common psychological problem in adults after depression. A mere 15% of those 8 million actually know they have ADD, however, and they have learned that fact recently within the last decade, give or take, because psychiatric textbooks didn't even recognize adult ADD as an official diagnosis until 1987. Now that ADD is an accepted part of the psychiatric repertory, however, doctors are seeing a surge in adults looking for a label for their lifelong restlessness. And just as the rise in the number of children given a diagnosis of ADD brought measurable change to the world of education, the wave of adults with the same constellation of quirks and needs is affecting the world of work. ADD makes work more complicated, said Harold Meyer, whose organization, the ADD Resource Center, in Manhattan, advises both employers and employees on how to manage the condition in the workplace. Already, employers are expected to be exquisitely sensitive, granting maternity, paternity, and adoption leave, subsidizing programs for weight loss and smoking cessation, providing domestic partner benefits, adapting physical space for every category of handicap, allowing for flex time, telecommuting, and job sharing. Adding yet another responsibility, and particularly for a syndrome whose symptoms look suspiciously like bad work habits, creates some skepticism. Meyer is regularly invited to address large companies, and whenever there are 15 or 20 managers in a room, they all think they have employees with ADD, and they don't know what to do about it, he said. They want to help. But they also ask, is it real? Or an excuse? Cheryl Moreno, a manager of human resources at Embry-Riddle, who has spent months working with Vivian Sales, trying to save her job, said she feels the same tug of desire to do the right thing mixed with frustration. We are feeling our way here, she said. Years ago this wasn't on the radar. Now we're seeing more of it. There's a climate here for helping people with impairments, she continued, but sometimes the impairments are too great. It was Moreno, in fact, who inadvertently led Sales to reveal her diagnosis last summer. Sales's job description included being backup for the specialist in charge of interlibrary loans, but she said she felt shaky in that role and had been told during her training for it that she had an accuracy problem. As it happened, Moreno needed to borrow a book from another library, and she came in on a day when the interlibrary loan specialist was out. Sales said she is certain that she entered that request into the computer and also printed out a copy for the specialist records. But when Moreno returned to pick up her book a few weeks later, it wasn't there. Neither was the paperwork nor any record in the computer. What resulted was a heated argument between Sales and the specialist who ran interlibrary loans. It ended with Sales sending a memo to her supervisor saying that she had a documented disability and was requesting an accommodation plan. My decision to come out of the closet was one of desperation, Sales told me when she speaks, her head darts, in a nervous, bird-like way, her eyes magnify behind glasses that constantly slide down her nose. The library director was ready to let me go, she said. I was playing the ADHD card. On the third floor of the New York Helmsley Hotel, in the red-carpeted Knickerbocker suite, a steady stream of adults sat at long, cloth-draped tables and filled out a short 6-question form. How often do you have trouble wrapping up the final details of a project once the challenging parts have been done? The questionnaire asked. How often do you have difficulty getting things in order when you have to do a task that requires organization? How often do you have problems remembering appointments or obligations? It continued. Then, when you have a task that requires a lot of thought, how often do you avoid or delay getting started? And how often do you fidget or squirm with your hands or feet when you have to sit down for a long time? Finally, how often do you feel overly active and compelled to do things like you were driven by a motor? The participants answered in gradations, from never to very often. When they finished, they met one-on-one with staff members from the Adult ADHD program at New York University, who were there to tell them whether they were, as one counselor put it, very good candidates for ADHD between 8:30 a.m. and 3:45 p.m. on this weekday in May. About 450 people registered for the screening. Of those who took the test, 85% were found to be at high risk for the disorder. That's far higher than in the population at large, said Dr. Leonard Adler, the associate professor of psychiatry and neurology at the NYU School of Medicine. This is a self-selecting group, and they came here in the first place because they were highly suspicious that they have this. What Adler was saying is this: yes, the numbers from the screening are high, but final determinations, the real diagnoses, are not made willy-nilly. Everyone who loses his keys once in a while, or drives off with a coffee cup on the roof of the car does not have a syndrome. The reason Adler makes his point so carefully is that he understands that many people, whether they say so outright or not, have a sneaking suspicion that ADD is little more than spaciness redefined as disease. You can't see it, you can't touch it, there's no litmus test for it, said Dr. John Ratty, co-author with Dr. Edward Hollowell of Driven to Distraction, which, when it was published in 1994, brought adult ADD to a mainstream audience for the first time. It's a spectrum diagnosis. There's no real test for depression either, but we accept that people are depressed. There are no real tests for a lot of things. What is different about ADD, though, is that its symptoms are a cluster of behaviors that nearly every human has at some point: forgetfulness, disorganization, and restlessness, along with the seemingly incongruous ability to focus intensely on one task to the exclusion of everything else. It is that very familiarity that breeds a level of contempt. Soul researchers like Adler and Ratty spend a lot of time explaining the difference between ADD and run-of-the-mill messiness. For starters, there are the physical differences. Brain scans show a difference in prefrontal cortex glucose metabolism in people with ADHD compared to control groups, said Dr. David W. Goodman, assistant professor in the psychiatry and behavioral sciences department at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And dopamine receptor density is greater in ADHD brains. Also, volumetric changes. In general, ADHD brains are smaller. If you have a patient do a color/word sorting test, ADHD lights up in a different area of the brain than non-ADHD. The hardwiring of the ADHD brain is different. Then there is the genetic evidence. If your child has it, Adler said, there's a 40% chance that a parent has it. If a parent has it, there's a 50% chance that a child will. These tendencies are not diagnoses, however. Brain imaging and genetics aside, ADD really exists only if it affects your life. What makes this real is the impairments, said Dr. Margaret Weiss, director of the ADHD clinic at the Children's and Women's Health Center in Vancouver, British Columbia. There is a tremendous difference between having some of the qualities and having the disorder. What we are talking about here is chronic, it's prevalent, it causes severe impairment. In other words, doctors know it when they see it. And what they see is a cohort of people who ping-pong from career to career and job to job, who are dynamite salesmen, but who never fill out expense accounts, who look like workaholics, because they are at their desks until midnight, but only because they don't really start to concentrate until panic sets in at 11 p.m., who are creative geniuses, but forget to bring the data to meetings. I've seen it, too, in recent months, while doing the research for this article. The interviews have been qualitatively different from those I have done with any other group in 20 years of reporting. The conversations could not be kept on track. The people I spoke to jumped from one subject to the next. And they were longer than most interviews I usually do, because the subjects were unusually animated, articulate and chatty. They arrived late. They fidgeted while we talked. They started to ask questions, but forgot where they were headed. They kept saying, one more thing, until I learned to be blunt to the point of rude in my goodbyes. One woman sent me long, bursting email messages, sometimes several of them a day, one of which literally ended, running off to my next project Zoom. One man called me on my cell phone at 8 on a Saturday night, because he thought of a question he had to ask. He would not be deterred, even when I told him I couldn't really talk, because I was visiting my father in the hospital. Robert Tudisco, a lawyer whose ADD was not diagnosed until he was an adult and who now represents clients with a disorder, tried to explain how it feels to live inside an ADD brain. As I sit here and talk to you in a relatively calm conversation, he said, there's an amusement park going on in my head. But even once you come to accept the reality of ADD, the question lingers, why now? If ADD is a function of biology as old as humankind, then why this growing glamour for diagnosis at this particular moment? One answer is that medical diagnoses ebb and flow with the times. Looked at through that lens, Western society seems ripe for this disorder. Now is a time when diagnosis can lead to action. Not only are there more medications to treat ADD, but Americans are arguably more willing to take pills to change their temperament. Also, other eras provided more jobs for people who needed to move and rather than sit and think, more jobs in factories, on farms, in door-to-door sales. Go even further back, and there were adventurers and pioneers. Today we sit at desks, in cubicles, staring at screens. Add to this the fact that the support systems that disguise disorganization for some people at work have eroded. People wouldn't suffer the effects of ADD if they could have the classic executive secretary who would proof their expense accounts and keep their calendars and get them to meetings, Ratty said. If I were to create an environment that is bad for ADD, it would be today's typical office. Ratty is the first to agree with what he sees as the general public's belief that ADD is probably overdiagnosed in children and in adults. But, like most in his field, he also says that it is simultaneously underdiagnosed. Yes, there are people who will throw this label at behavior that does not fit the criteria of the condition, he said. But there's no doubt that the condition is real. and the much bigger number is those who have it, but have not been diagnosed. ADD looks different in adults than it does in children. There are two general categories of the disorder, with and without hyperactivity, and adults tend to exhibit the kind without. That may explain another difference as well. It was long thought that ADD was primarily a disorder of boys. Twice as many boys receive the diagnosis as girls, but psychiatrists like Adler are finding that the ratio of men to women in his adult clinic is a fairly even split. The most logical explanation for the discrepancy is that boys are much more likely to have the hyperactive form of ADD, and it is the children who are bouncing out of their seats in class who are most likely to be given the diagnosis. The subtler and attentive form is more common in girls, who may well appear spacey or disorganized through their school years, but who underachieve quietly and don't disrupt the class. They hit the wall only when they reach adulthood and need to juggle the demands of life and work. Today's children, or at least the ones who call enough attention to themselves, may prove to be fortunate. Those whose condition is diagnosed early are armed with a modern arsenal of weapons, chemical and otherwise, and have spent their school years learning how to manage their ADD, said Wilma Feldman, author of numerous books about ADD and work. They have had the chance to become quite prepared. Those whose conditions are diagnosed when they are adults, however, like Vivienne Sales, have no such preparation. They have to undo decades of damage and do so while somehow holding on to a job. Carl Mandiola is 37, and he can list more than 50 jobs that he has run through in his working life. He has tended bar, served in the Air Force, and been an EMT. He has sold Amway products, water beds, cookies, shoes, and long-distance phone service. He has worked security at a supermarket, been a janitor in a medical lab, made pizza at a fast food joint, and assembled butyl rubber inerts for compression tanks on a factory line. In all, he has been fired from a dozen jobs for poor performance, and from a half dozen more because he was downsized, and he left the rest because he became antsy and bored. For most of these years he had no label for this restlessness. But he called himself quite a number of names: lazy, loser, stupid. In his late 20s, however, he found a niche in the world of graphic design. He taught himself to do artwork on the computer in a style that is whimsical and bold. He landed a position at a small publishing house in Boston, creating invitations, advertisements, and brochures. It was one of the few jobs he had ever had in which he was closely supervised, an advantage for most workers with ADD, but also free to set his own hours, another advantage. "I turned on at night," he said. "That's when I got things done. All I needed was a good cup of coffee. All the distractions were gone." Mandiola had been working at the publishing house for more than 2 years, a personal record, when he moved to New York to marry in early 2001. By then his field was changing rapidly, and cost-cutting meant that fewer people were expected to do more work with less direction. He found, and lost, several jobs that had neither the structure nor the flexibility he needed. "I'm not a multitasker," he said, words that could be a slogan for ADD. "I was used to one or two projects at a time, and they were working 7 or 8 projects, and they wanted it all done in a day." It was this crisis that led him to a psychiatrist and a diagnosis of ADD. Now unemployed and with a newborn son, he is thinking of leaving the design field entirely. He says he wants to become a real estate investor or a television writer. ADD shows many faces in the workplace, but Mandiola's story includes the features prominent in most of them: the choppy resume, the tendency to rise to a challenge in the beginning, but to unravel as the work devolves from interesting to routine. True, changes in the world of work mean that a peripatetic work history has become more acceptable to potential employers, and while that does make it somewhat easier than it might otherwise be for workers with ADD to get a job, at least in a good economy, it does not make it easier for them to keep one. A recent Roper poll of adults who identify themselves as having ADHD found that they held 5.4 jobs over the past 10 years, compared with 3.4 jobs for adults without the disorder. The same poll found that only 52% of adults with ADD are currently employed, compared with 72% of unaffected adults. Vivian Sales had an equally checkered work history. After graduating from Indiana University in 1986, she earned a master's degree in international studies from Ohio University. She then worked as a building inspector with the Indiana Department of Labor, did data entry for the Long-Term Credit Bank of Japan, waited on tables at a Japanese restaurant, and taught English in Korea. Few jobs lasted for more than a year. In 1999, she was fired from two technical writing jobs within 3 months, then went on to leave seven part-time jobs and fail a four-week teacher training course. Near the end of 1999, she entered graduate school again for a degree in library science. "I'm good at finding information," she reasoned. She was also better at being a student than being an employee. She said she thinks the discipline of the classroom kept her on track. While she maintained a B average in the program, concern over her fractured career path led her to see a job counselor in July 2000. The trip to the counselor led to testing, which led to a diagnosis of ADD. Like many others with the condition, Sales has other issues as well. As many as 50% of ADD patients have another syndrome during their lifetime, most commonly depression, anxiety disorder, learning disabilities, or bipolar disorder, Adler said. For Sales, the co-travelers were narcolepsy and dyslexia. It was a diagnosis that brought both relief and regret. "It explains so much," she said. "Most people cannot believe that someone with three university degrees could be such a washout in the real world." The first step after diagnosis is often medication. Drugs tend not to work without monitoring and therapy, Adler said, but he also finds that counseling alone is not enough. Psychiatrists like Adler compare ADD medications to driving a car. "It's easier than walking, but only if you know how to drive." Robert Tudisco, the lawyer with the amusement park in his brain, describes the role of medication this way: "Before the drugs, I could walk through a room, and I wouldn't even see it was a mess. With the drugs, I see it's a mess. It bothers me that it's a mess. I want to do something about it. So now I'm ready to learn how to clean it up." Unlike nearly every other medicine on the market, ADD treatments were first tested in children, because for decades it was not thought that they were needed for adults. Until very recently, all these drugs were officially approved for ADD only in those under 18 and were prescribed off-label for that purpose to anyone else. These drugs were stimulants, like Ritalin, and they were dispensed in dosages meant to get a child through a school day. Recently, the pharmaceutical world began to develop new formulations designed to last longer, particularly helpful in the workplace. At the end of 2002, the Food and Drug Administration approved the first medication specifically for use in adults. Atomoxetine, which is sold under the name Strattera, is not a stimulant, but an norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, and it can last for a full day. Strattera has an additional advantage because it allows workers to do jobs machine or truck operator, for instance, or airplane pilot, that could be dangerous under the influence of such stimulants. Even when drugs mitigate the symptoms of ADD, however, they rarely eliminate the complications of workplace interactions. At 50, C. Lonnie Weiner has the typical wandering ADD resume jobs in office administration, followed by jobs in sales, followed by her current profession, social work. In fact, she has struggled so much in her work life that she changed her name along the way. She became C. Lonnie in 2002 in order to leave the failures of Cheryl Lonnie behind. Weiner also battles depression and suffers from thyroid disease and diabetes. "I think it's hysterical," she said, laughing remarkably, she is often laughing, "that it takes 8 medications every day to make me feel normal." A longtime New Yorker, she moved to New Mexico 7 years ago and went through 5 jobs there in the next 6 years. Since 2003, she has worked as a social worker for an area hospice and part-time at a psychiatric hospital. Both jobs were at risk shortly after she began. Her supervisor at the hospice found her difficult to work with and worried about her effect on families. "It was hard for C. Lonnie to focus," said Karen Newcomb, who became Weiner's boss last summer. She'd come in and tell me she wanted to talk to me. She'd end up going in 5 or 6 directions. She couldn't decide what was the most important thing to talk about. She was just taking so much of my time. More so than any other employee. It didn't take Newcomb long to decide that Weiner was creating other problems at work. She's in hospice, Newcomb said. She's dealing with families in crisis. She was supposed to calm them down. I know the effect she was having on me, and I can't see how she would be very helpful. One of the myriad wrinkles of ADD is impulsivity. In Weiner's case, this shows up in her tendency to speak before stopping to think. In one staff meeting at a previous job, for instance, she voiced the opinion that a patient about to be released from the hospital won't pay attention to anything anyone says, and we should just let him drink himself to death. In another meeting, I said a patient was a bitch. It was true, and everyone knew it was true, but I was fired for it. The fallout from similar behavior in her current job sent her in tears to the therapist who had diagnosed her disorder. She met with a psychopharmacologist the next day and left that appointment with a prescription for Strattera. She had resisted taking medication until then, she said, feeling that she was already taking so much for her other medical conditions. But she started on this newest pill, she said, to save my job. She did not immediately mention that choice to anyone at work, but Newcomb said she noticed a change within days. Out of nowhere, she started coming into my office and was more focused. Newcomb told me I commented to her that I had seen a change, and that's when she told me about the ADD and the medication. As Weiner described it, Strattera slows her frenetic brain. I've gone from 100 miles per hour to 80 miles per hour, which is still way faster than anyone I know, she said. I feel calmer inside. Instead of darting from one thing to the next and never finishing anything, I can take on one thing at a time. Which does not mean that she has become a shy and circumspect employee. Medication addresses ADD symptoms. It does not transform personality. In the year since she began taking medication, Weiner has been written up for inappropriate comments. But she says she feels victorious nonetheless, knowing what her boss don't. That many times she followed the advice of her therapist and did not fly off the handle. Instead, she waited 24 hours and used that time to role-play a more measured response with her husband. So far she has managed to save her hospice job. If she had not gone on medication, she would have put her job in jeopardy, Newcomb said. But she acted too late to keep her part-time position at the psychiatric hospital, where both patients and staff members have complained about her rudeness. I think, before I went on MEDS, I burned my bridges there, Weiner said. When the time came for her annual review this spring, she said, she was taken aside by a supervisor and told that it would be best if she resigned. So she quit before she could be fired. In this litigious age, where suits are brought over the temperature of a cup of coffee, you would expect a flood of employees with ADD seeking job protection under the law. Yet, at best, there is barely a trickle. There's no landmark case, said Patricia Latham, who, with her husband, Peter Latham, is the author of a series of seminal books on disabilities and the law. The message sent by the scattered cases that do exist, she said, is not encouraging to others who might think of bringing more. ADD can be covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act, as well as state anti-discrimination laws. But those who try to prove they have been discriminated against because of their ADD must show that they are highly debilitated by their disorder, yet still capable of doing their jobs if their employer would provide reasonable accommodations. In short, plaintiffs must walk the tightrope of all disability employment law. You have to be substantially impaired, Latham said, but not so impaired that you do not qualify for your job in the first place. That narrow line is why more than 90% of cases brought by employees under the ADA are not won, Latham estimated. That statistic includes all disabilities, she added, and does not account for the additional, intangible hurdles faced by workers with hidden syndromes, like ADD. Ours is a society in which excuses are inexcusable. Over the generations, we have learned tolerance for some disabilities, but mostly those that we can't see. Quirks in the wiring of the mind still generate very little sympathy. If you are missing a limb, I understand that you can't do the same job as I can without help. If you are chronically late for work, however, I am much less likely to understand why you can't try harder to be on time. It doesn't feel wrong to dismiss someone for disorganization, or laziness, or a brusque manner with customers. In fact, it feels right. Taking ADD to court, therefore, is often an uphill battle. Unless there is some clear evidence of discrimination, glowing reviews that turn negative immediately after the boss told the worker has ADD, for instance, there isn't much chance of prevailing under the ADA, said John Barenbaum, a plaintiff's attorney who specializes in disability law. Employees who are not given reasonable accommodations have some recourse, but the definition of reasonable is limited under the law and does not involve changing the essential job description. Those who counsel ADD employees, therefore, often advise them not to bother with the clerks. I get calls saying, I need to come in late, and my boss won't let me, can I sue? Said Harold Meyer, who, in addition to advising companies and employees on ADD-friendly workplace strategies, is chairman of the New York City chapter of Children and Adults with Attention Deficit/Hyperactivity Disorder, known as CHAD. I tell them, you can sue, but you won't win. In short, the realm of work is a universe away from the realm of education for those with ADD in the public school system. A child's diagnosis is like an admission ticket. Districts are obligated to help students whose learning is impaired by their ADD in the world of work. The burden is on the ADD employee to help himself. That did not stop Vivienne Sales from asking her employer for help. The day after her argument over the interlibrary loan request, she sent a memo to her supervisor. It read, I have the following documented disabilities that require accommodation, then listed her ADD, followed by her accompanying diagnosis. I am requesting a 504 accommodation plan, the memo continued, using the language of disability law, which she had looked up on the internet. That first memo was followed by a second one, 2 weeks later, addressed to Cheryl Moreno, the manager of Human Resources, whose book request had been lost. I need an accommodation to be able to perform my job duties because of a disability, Sales wrote, and she went on to explain what steps she had already taken on her own. Using two different day planners, one is left at work, the other is always with me each day at work. I compare the entries in both day planners to make sure I do not have any scheduling conflicts. Create tracking charts for projects. I use tracking charts to keep track of the seminars that I present for the semester. Using a small microcassette recorder, I record items that need to be done for the next day. Then I play back the tape and write down what I have said into my day planners. Using flex scheduling to go to counseling and doctor appointments, I make up my time by working late. But these strategies alone were not enough, she wrote in her memo, and she told Moreno what else she would need. Educating my co-workers about my condition, so they will get a better understanding of it. Having set deadlines on when projects should be completed. Giving weekly progress reports to my supervisor. In turn, my supervisor checks on my progress on a weekly or bi-weekly basis. She sent the memo via inter-office mail. Then she waited to be fired. Aonaki did not walk into Jennifer Goretzky's office on a recent spring day, so much as she swept in, radiating exuberance and energy. Key is a second-grade teacher, by all accounts the kind you would want your child to have. Goretzky is her ADD coach. Their twice-weekly sessions are rivets in the infrastructure that is rising within the world of adults suffering from ADD. Key settled herself on the couch across from Goretzky and started to explain that she loves her job, loves teaching children. But while all the other teachers are gone by 4:30, after an 8-hour workday, Key is sometimes there until 7. The custodian tells me I have to leave because he has to mop the floors, she said. Then she brings a satchel of materials home and works until bedtime. The two women spent the rest of the session mapping out the time management plan for Key. Let's look at some things you can take off your plate, Goretzky said. It's not like you have an assistant you can delegate to, but what you do have are kids in the classroom. How much of the classroom management can go to them? Gee's eyes widened. She had never thought of this. Everything in your class is already clearly labeled, right? Koletsky asked. It is, Key answered. And the children like to help, right? Oh, yes, they do, Key said, and she was off and running. The books in the classroom library are labeled on the back to show what baskets they go in. They can put the books away. They can put away the crayons and pencils and things that I am forever cleaning up after they are gone. I can make a list of all the possible jobs within the classroom. We already have a daily job board. I can also make an afternoon job board, and each afternoon we could stop and take just a few minutes to do those. I have 19 students. If we spent 10 minutes, I just thought of a job. Museum curator. They could help me set up the boards where their work is displayed. So this idea sounds like it would work? Koletsky asked. It's a plan, he said. Coaches are not therapists. They are either self-taught, or, like Koletsky, they are graduates of places, like the ADD Coach Academy, which charges $3,695 for a 9-month curriculum taught over the phone and online. Coaches concentrate on what, how, and when, never why, said Nancy Ratty, a non-stop whirlwind who helped create this field from scratch as a roundabout way of managing her own ADHD. Married to John Ratty, co-author of Driven to Distraction, she coaches from her home, which is covered, bedrooms to boiler room, with notes reminding her to close this door, leave that one open, plan a vacation, fix the garage door. Unlike Koletsky, who meets with Key in person, once a week, and again by telephone or email, that same week, Ratty does nearly all of her coaching by phone. She has coached clients as far away as Moscow, and as close as across town, without ever seeing them, charging up to $400 an hour for her services. Ratty takes 15 clients at a time, and she describes them as a mix of executives, professors, lawyers, doctors, and authors. One attorney called her because his secretary threatened to quit unless he found himself a coach. One chronically late advertising executive asked Ratty to train his administrative assistant to check on his preparation progress every 15 minutes. Ratty has instructed assistants to ask the boss to empty his pockets of all accumulated business cards when he returns from meetings and to take the boss's car keys until important reports are finished. Permit me a detour here, since detours are certainly fitting for this story. My favorite adaptive strategy was used by Robert Tudisco. His son was enrolled in a preschool directly across the street from his law office. Yet every afternoon, Tudisco arrived late for pickup. Tudisco tried everything he could think of to get himself out the door on time: reminders on his watch, his computer, his Palm Pilot, his alarm clock, and then he noticed that his paralegal, whose workday stopped at 5, always left precisely on time. So he told her that she wasn't allowed to walk out the door without me, even if she needed to physically yank him from his chair. Most often, though, it is the ADD-afflicted individual, not the support staff, who signs up for coaching. While the coach's role is technically to help with the day-to-day mechanics of work, most coaches find themselves advising clients on less concrete problems, like whether their particular job, and even their entire profession, is a good fit. It is accepted wisdom in ADD circles that certain types of work are a nightmare for those with ADD. Accounting comes to mind, and that others are virtual magnets for those with the condition: sales, contracting, waitressing, hairdressing, any job that involves chatting and moving around, stock trading, acting, law enforcement, emergency medicine, any job that runs on adrenaline and deadline. Journalism is thought to be full of people with ADD, doctors and coaches tell me. Yes, I took the screening test. I have many of the tendencies, but not the disorder. Entrepreneurs with ADD often thrive as well, but only if they have a partner who is good at paperwork. Unfortunately for Vivian Sales, librarian is not on the list. and yet, it is what she most wants to be. Sales was not dismissed after her argument in the library last summer. Instead, she found an unexpected advocate in Cheryl Moreno. The HR manager said she believed that the rules would have permitted the library to dismiss Sales until the moment Sales declared that she had a disability. At that point, the rules change. The median cost of accommodations for impaired employees is $240, Moreno said, quoting a statistic in Vogue at human resource conferences. So we tried to help. In Sales's case, the help cost more than $240 and came in the form of a job coach whose $100 per hour services were paid for by the university. Finding such a coach in Prescott, Aries, took most of last autumn, and it was not until the end of last year that Sales began working with Evelyn Mariba, a vocational specialist from the West Java Par Guidance Clinic, who was not specifically trained to work with adults with ADD, but who brought up a grandson who has the condition. During January and February, Mariba met with Sales at the library. Their work started with her desk, which took 2 hours to straighten up. Then they tackled her time management, dividing Sales's workload in two sections, and creating interim timetables. That worked when it came to ordering her quota of graphic novels, which she finished on time, but was not quite as successful when it came to reviewing periodicals for the library's collection. Despite a detailed template, the first batch of reviews that Sales turned in were handwritten, and her boss had to advise her to type them up on the computer. Lariba said, she has never seen a client work harder. You couldn't ask for anyone who is more dedicated to doing a good job, Lariba said of Sales. She tried desperately hard. Once a month, Sales met with her supervisor, Evelyn Harris, to discuss her progress. The portrait painted in Harris's memos is one of incredible determination and effort, but only incremental change. Harris said that both she and Sales were determined to make it work. I approached Vivian's training as I would with a brand new person, Harris said. We agreed we would start from ground zero and build. In the January report, Sales was chided for missing a deadline for a student newspaper because of a computer problem, missing a meeting because she forgot, despite 3 email reminders, and missing a day of work because she forgot to take her medication. She failed to straighten the library bulletin board where students post for sale and for rent notices. She yawned through an entire meeting without covering her mouth, leading Harris to reprimand her for unprofessional behavior. From our discussion today and the list of things that are not getting done, I feel that you are not multitasking, Harris wrote. You focus on 1 or 2 projects. And ignore the other daily/weekly tasks that need to be done on an ongoing basis. You will work with Evelyn Lariba during the next 2 weeks on time management skills and prioritizing techniques. Startling fact about the world of ADD is the number of people who are grateful for the disorder who consider it the best part of themselves. David Neilman, for instance, the founder of JetBlue Airways, has said that he will not take medication for his ADD, fearing that it would make him just like everybody else. It's the source of my creativity and my drive, echoed Thomas Apple, who was given a diagnosis about 7 years ago when he was in his early 40s and went on to create the world's largest video display for stock market quotations. You can think outside the box because you're not in a box. ADD is the greatest thing that happened to me, said Sam Grossman, who became a partner in the Albert Corporation, a real estate company based in Brookline, Mass., 2 years ago, when he was 22. I wish I could hire 4 or 5 people like me with ADD, he said. The impulsivity that comes with this means I can walk into a building, see things an ordinary person wouldn't see, and act on my gut right away. Even the slim chance that such success is possible kept Sales going. I see things in ways that other people don't, she said. As an example, she told me about how another librarian happened to mention that a copy of the Seabiscuit DVD was missing. That same morning, Sales happened to pass the interlibrary loan shelf and was distracted by a glimpse of something out of place. It was the Wayward DVD. At about the same time, Sales was training students to enter information in a database of aviation-themed periodicals. It was boring, repetitive work. Year, month, volume number, titles, features, keywords, and sales hated it. While trying to find new books for the collection, sales accidentally found herself not in her library's database, but in a commercial one that included almost exactly the same information. "Our project was reinventing the wheel," she said. "Other companies were already doing this work." So she wrote a memo on the computer, not by hand, and presented it to her boss, practically giddy at her efficiency. She told her coach these two stories, over and over, certain they would save her job. Success, however, is a matter of perspective, and what sales saw as victory, Lariba saw merely as what others do effortlessly every day. She did not share that with sales, however, letting her client savor the feeling of accomplishment. "That memo was my best work," sales remembered. "It only had one typo." Sales's determination to do the job right was certainly noticed. There was praise in her next evaluation. "Your presentation was well organized, your PowerPoint slides were effective, and your personal demeanor was professional," Harris wrote in March. Lariba had advised sales on her outfit, double-checking that it was pressed. "That was very good." But there was criticism too, and a tone that sounded like a boss building a paper trail. Sales was cited for lapses that she says she suspected would not be held against any of her co-workers. It gave her the feeling that she couldn't win, no matter how hard she might try. By April, it was clear that the fight was over. Sales was told that she had taken too much time with too little result preparing a display for Black History Month, and too little time updating the library's emergency and disaster manuals. She had introduced items in meetings that were not on the agenda. She had recommended the purchase of books without realizing that the library had already ordered them. She had recommended the purchase of electronic devices, without first conferring with the electronic services librarian. "Your response when I question your recommendation was, oops." This final evaluation came with an attached list of available positions elsewhere in the university. Of those, 7 required advanced training or degrees that sales did not have, 1 was a part-time slot in the copying center, and 1 was interlibrary loan specialist, the job that started all the trouble in the first place. After reading the list, sales went home and lay in bed with an ice pack on her head. As a part of sales's severance package, she received 16 hours with her vocational coach, and Lariba spent much of that time discouraging sales from applying for jobs that involved too much multitasking or would require her to relocate. Sales said she thinks a move to another state or even another country might provide a clean slate and a new start. Lariba said she thinks a move would be nothing but overwhelming. "You have to ask yourself, are you running to something or are you running away from something?" the coach told her client. "You can't run away from ADD." Lisa Belkin is a contributing writer for the magazine,